You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, Bob.
Hi, Bob.
How are you?
Oh, good.
Good. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright. This is The Wright Show on Blogging Heads TV. You are Robert Jervis, very well-known political scientist, in particular a scholar of international relations at Columbia. And more specifically, you put a lot of study into the role that the human mind plays in international relations, properties of the human mind, quirks of the human mind, and it would be natural that these influences are consequential, given the fact that international relations consists of human beings interacting with one another. And you got a new book out called How Statesmen Think, The Psychology of International Politics, from Princeton University Press, which encompasses a lot of your recent work on a very diverse array of topics. So I thought maybe we could start out by just talking about some contemporary issues and asking how they look from your point of view, given the emphasis of yours that I've just described. So let's take North Korea. That's been a pretty active arena.
Yes.
You know, you've had, maybe you don't need any more prompting. I mean, what does it look like? What's going on from your point of view?
Yeah, well, it's a fascinating and potentially quite dangerous situation, one I've sort of followed ever since the Korean War, because we've had problems with North Korea since then. A number of things jump out at me that I think are typical and some that are atypical. I think what's typical is first the difficulty of understanding how others see the world. It's especially true cross-culturally, but you know, even within cultures, it's hard. I mean, I think most Americans think, okay, it's a terrible country, but they sort of we understand how they see things, and we probably don't. And the first thing I think decision makers have to deal with, and it's very, very difficult, is to realize how little they understand about, you know, what others are up to. And the second thing related, and you really see it in an extreme way, I think, with the Trump administration, is that they think when they're trying to send a message, it will be received as intended, or at least even if it's not fully given credit, that basically you're on the same wavelength. And for instance, I think it was Tillerson, some member of the administration, said that probably Pence, that the bombing, attack on Syria, and then the use of the Moab, the big bomb, mm-hmm. on Afghanistan, showed the Kim Jong-un that, you know, we're serious and we're tough. And well, you know, that might be true. I don't mean to imply that isn't. But what's clear is we don't know how he received the, quote, message. I'm using air quotes, especially because Trump himself said he did not order the dropping of the bomb on Afghanistan. A little hard to see how that would be received as a message from Trump. I think most Americans feel that's the message that was intended, and sort of feel its meaning is self-evident. Well, very little is self-evident. And if I were Kim Jong-un, it's possible I'd receive it very differently. First, I might think, this has nothing to do with me. I mean, we're talking about what he's doing in Syria, what he's doing in Afghanistan. What do these have to do with North Korea? Second, he could feel, oh, that's interesting. If you don't have nuclear weapons, you get cruise missiles coming down on your airfields and you get big bombs dropped on you. Substitute for countries like mine that are really tough. Or he might think, you know, they've been fighting in Afghanistan 16 years, 15 years. I mean,
roughly.
And they still can't win it. And that shows they're weak or desperate. And on Syria, he might think, Trump wants him to think, oh, I did what Obama didn't, what no one has done. It's really big. He might look at it and say, gee, Assad broke every rule in the rule book, killed all these people, did the horrible, and what did Trump do? Spent how many million dollars? A lot of money to destroy, 10 airplanes of mine? This is, he didn't do anything. So I'm not saying that any of those interpretations are necessarily the ones Kim Jong-un or others in North Korea have made. But what I am saying is not helpful to decision makers, but important for us to realize it's awfully hard to know how others are seeing us. And it's, I think, a very human reaction, but terrible error in foreign policy to make the easy assumption, I know what I want to convey, or I know what I'd like to have conveyed, and that's what others get. No wonder, you get crosswise with these things. And of course, sorry to go on, but let me add the marvelous thing, of course, about the aircraft, the Armada. It is an Armada. I don't mean to make fun of it, that we sent. And
to the one that we sent in the direction of North Korea, you mean, ultimately?
Ultimately, yes. So Mattis, who knows what he's talking about even when Trump doesn't, say, the Armada is going to North Korea. And as you know, it was going to Australia and then turned around and went there. What does Kim Jong-un make of that? Well, I think I understand part of what happened. I've talked to people who know the Navy. I mean, it's a bizarre story, but it makes sense if you put in a lot of odd things, which Kim Jong-un probably doesn't know and wouldn't care about. So how does he interpret that? I mean, I have no idea. It's crazy. And, our policy has to be, it's frustrating because our policy has to be built on how they see the world. Mm-hmm. And that's always got uncertainties. So what you've got is a very difficult problem coupled with what's very, I think, psychologically difficult to deal with. The more sophisticated a decision maker you are, the greater uncertainty you have, the more you realize that you may be wrong or that things may not be coming through or may see things differently. And, I can say that as an academic, not my responsibility, but for people whose lives, others' lives and the future of the fate of countries rest on it, that is a terrible burden. I think that's one reason why they don't understand this.
Mm-hmm. Now, the sense of alarm about the ongoing nuclear program in North Korea is premised on the idea that once they have a nuclear warhead on a missile that can reach the United States is in grave danger. And, of course, there are countries that have those, but we wake up every morning without worrying about it. And so it seems to me if you probe this a little, the unspoken and sometimes spoken premise is that North Korea's leader is either, on the one hand, fanatically ideological with some kind of hatred of the United States that could lead him to launch a preemptive strike, or that he's crazy. Seem to me the two implied scenarios.
Well, I think there's a third. I think they're wrong, and I do want very much to talk about them. The third is sort of somewhat in between. Not to launch a preemptive attack, but he thinks we will be deterred so he can undertake what we call provocations. I don't think the word is really a good one because it isn't meant to get around, but he can undertake nasty actions against South Korea. And if we look back at the history, partly of him, but of his father and grandfather, they've done things. They tried to assassinate South Korean president. They've blown up half the South Korean cabinet when they were in a third country. Mm-hmm. They've blown up the airliner. They've sunk a small South Korean vessel. They've done a lot of things that are outside the norms. But you can't exclude these things. I think it's unlikely, but the point you started with is the one that strikes me. I'm old enough. You're probably old enough to remember what people said would happen if China got the bomb. Not only sort of a lot of right-wing wackos, but Kennedy, before he was assassinated, was extraordinarily concerned about this. And one reason Kennedy was hesitant to fight in Vietnam was he felt when China gets the bomb, it's all over anyway, all over for Southeast Asia. He's going to dominate because of the way in which the bomb will give him diplomatic leverage. Well, if we look at the behavior of China from the revolution on, and I use the nice thing that the men in black use, you know, the memory eraser. But I just erase your memory of when North Korea gets, when China either first exploded a bomb, then got missiles. I ask you to look at the interaction and tell me when those things happened. You can't tell me.
Yeah, in fact, when you brought it up, I was thinking, I have no idea when China got... I have no idea whether that happened within my memory, because I don't remember it, even though if it happened after Kennedy,
yeah,
I was at least a sentient child,
yeah.
So I could have remembered it. But you're right. Now, why is it that tends not to make a difference? I mean, is the point that nuclear weapons are so devastating and hence almost unthinkable that nobody really believes that you're going to use them, right?
It's filled with paradoxes. I've written two books on nuclear weapons, and I've got a talk I work on and eventually should write up, because the paradoxes build, you know, just go deeper and deeper or spread out. And Trump asked the right question, and I think, although much as I think Trump is terrible, I want to say, it's, he often asks the right question. Then he doesn't pause to think about it or, you know, get information. He said, what good are nuclear weapons if you can't use them? That is the essential question to ask. He's absolutely right. And the experts have dealt with that from the beginning. My former colleague at UCLA, since deceased, Bernard Brody, marvelous scholar and person, in 1946 wrote a marvelous two sentences, which I will not get 100% right. He said, until now, the purpose of weapons has been to win wars. From now on, the purpose of nuclear weapons must be to prevent wars. They can have no other sensible purpose.
Mm-hmm.
That's right, but of course it's paradoxical, because what we're saying is, at least when both sides have retaliatory capability, they can't be used. If they can't be used, how do they influence? But they do influence, because there's a residual chance of things going very wrong through any number of pathways, many of which we don't understand. And so they can have great impact, and they have what Tom Schelling, who was one of my mentors, Nobel Prize winner, died about a year ago,
yeah,
a very important scholar and very clear thinker. Tom talked about utility in non-use.
Mm-hmm.
But there's got to be the residual fear. But it is, you know, it is very, you know, people get very frustrated, and I think rightly so, because I'm saying two somewhat contradictory things, that know that they're not going to be used. People are sensible, but people are sensible because they realize there's a slight danger of things getting out of hand. If there were no danger, then they wouldn't matter at all.
So
it's the very danger that makes them matter, but keeps us safe, I would argue. Others obviously disagree.
But in your view, is India-Pakistan a case where you might expect there to have been more bloodshed, given the longstanding tensions between them, had they not both now for a long time possessed nuclear weapons?
Yeah, there are two things. There's a big argument in the community of scholars working on this called the proliferation optimists and the proliferation pessimists. And the optimists say, first, that nuclear weapons stabilize the Soviet-American relationship, and I've strongly argued that again, people disagree, and, you know, I don't think it's open and shut, but, you know, I can give you the arguments. But anyway, the proliferation optimists extend that and say, well, it'll work in every other pair. And the most vocal of this was my good friend and late colleague Ken Waltz, who said, more may be better. I still have my Ken Waltz pin that we developed for his memorial service.
Yeah, he was kind of extreme. I mean, he really literally thought the more nuclear weapons in the world, the better. The more proliferation, the better, right? Because they were stabilizing. You
know, Ken didn't, yes, he said that. And his last article was on Iran, saying it would make things better if Iran got nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. Little secret is, Ken loved provoking people. Mm-hmm. He's a great teacher. He wanted people to think. And he liked stirring things up. And he was a contrarian. So he didn't quite believe the extreme position he took in some of the publications. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he did write that. And he certainly thought that they often stabilize things. And he did argue they did on the subcontinent. I am in between. I'm more, you know, there's some people very pessimistic. I'm sort of in between the subcontinent. I still worry. On the one hand, Ken would point out that since India and Pakistan got weapons, been remarkably stable compared to the previous period. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there was the Kargil incident, not terribly well known to most people. There was a small war on a glacier in the far north. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to turn that. I'm going to let that ring, but not answer it.
That's
sorry.
Okay.
You know, that was somewhat dangerous, but not enormously. And there's been nothing since, even though there have been a number of really quite significant provocations. Mm-hmm. But no, I'm worried. I do think the danger of a war on the, if there's a nuclear war, by far most likely is the subcontinent. Mm-hmm. Because the geography is very bad. They're very close to each other. They have primitive warning systems. India could arguably wipe out Pakistan's nuclear weapons. There are also problems with command and control systems. Only an extreme optimist and also someone who neglects the practical problems. And Ken was a theorist. Mm-hmm. He wished away a lot of the problems. I think you have to go that far to be an optimist about the subcontinent. Mm-hmm. But I want to go back one thing, if I could, on Korea that really mm-hmm. brings out, again, the paradoxes or the troublesome thing. What you said is exactly right. We've said, Trump especially, clearly, but really implicit in Obama, he was worried about this, that if North Korea gets ICBM capability with nuclear warhead against the U.S., that's terrible. Well, that means that we think if North Korea gets this capability, he'll be able to deter us. He'll be able to coerce us. Well, that's not a great bargaining. It's a good bargaining position in one way, because it says, we know if this happens, it's going to be awful. So if we think it's going to be awful, we have the incentive to stop you, even if it's dangerous. Mm-hmm. But there's a downside, right? If we don't do anything, and eventually he gets ICBMs topped by nuclear weapons, he says, well, they've told me that once we have this, they're going to fold their cards.
Right.
So I can really bully them. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not something you want them to believe. So this is a bargaining, if not a paradox, a trade-off in what we're doing to make our threats to increase the pressure and even use all the options that are on the table, to use the trite phrase. That simultaneously puts us behind the eight ball if we don't prevent them, mm-hmm. and that increases the incentives for us to actually use force. I think if North Korea got an ICBM with nuclear weapons, I'm not happy with that. I don't mean to, yeah. Oh, that's fine. I think the consequences would be very limited. Kim Jong-un, no evidence he's crazy. And when Madeleine Albright met his father, she said, hey, he's not cut off from the world. He's not stupid. He's not out of it. I've talked to the people who've negotiated, not with him, but with the top negotiators. They say they know how to negotiate. Mm-hmm. There's nothing strange about them. This is not weird. It's normal, nasty internet politics, which means it's tough. But I don't see any evidence leading to the extreme conclusions.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned the challenge of understanding the person on the other side of the table, the way their mind works, and I take it you believe that that's often a good thing, often a stabilizing thing. Trump is an interesting case because on the one hand, he will like for much of the political campaign, you would have thought he was just completely incapable of understanding anyone's perspective, because it's like the lying media, the blah, blah, blah. And, you know, reporters are basically people doing their jobs under a certain incentive structure, okay? And I mean, you know, you could just go down the line where there's another way of characterizing the people he's talking about that is more charitable and more accurate, probably. Yeah. And but then he'll have these flashes where, you know, you take the Kim Jong-un, if that's the right name. I get my Kims mixed up. I get my Kims mixed up. But you know, whereas the only thing I remember George Bush saying about him is, I loathe, or I guess that was his, that his father, or was that him? Anyway, was him. He said, I loathe him. Well, that's probably not a recipe for a good perspective taking to start off like that. But whereas Trump just suddenly comes out and says, you got to understand, he's suddenly at a young age, he inherits a whole country. Now that's the beginning of true understanding. Yeah. But it seems bizarre in light of so many other things. Trump, what is your reading on the way Trump's mind works? Yeah.
Well, that's really a good point, and I will admit to not being sure. And although, as I say, I'm very critical of Trump's policies, both domestic and foreign, and all sorts of things. That there's some very interesting things about this guy. And the contrast between George W. and Trump is very interesting here, that Trump, in a way, is non-judgmental.
Right.
And W. and many others are, well, typical American, that looking at others as evil. And, you know, the axis of evil, all these things. He's a tyrant, therefore he's evil. That goes along with the general belief in American exceptionalism, that the U.S. is different from all countries in a good way, and we could tick off all the reasons why. And Trump is not like that. And Trump says, you remember when people say, well, Putin's a killer, and Trump said, well, we're not so good ourselves, which is, on the one hand, refreshing, because I don't think our leaders are as bad as Putin, but I think that perspective of, hey, we've done evil in the world, we're like them, we're all human, we're all out for our self-interest, America first, well, that's not odd, because it's Russia first and North Korea first and South. In a way, that's both accurate and healthy, and so that's very unusual, and I think can make him clear-eyed in some of these people, and that although perhaps in just visceral reaction to Assad's use of poison gas, he seemed to adopt the more normal American thing about how evil, that seemed to quickly pass from his view, and I think return to the more let's
That represented a kind of departure from his campaign rhetoric, which, as you said, had been kind of, you might say, hyper-realist in foreign policy terms, right? And maybe we should pause a little and say one thing about foreign policy realism, which is non-judgmental. I mean, as a governing kind of ideology, as opposed to a descriptive thing, which it also is, but as a guide for policy, realism involves trying to understand the interests that leaders have, acknowledging that they will pursue their interests and you can't expect otherwise, and understanding what constraints are working on them and so on, and saying, look, you got to deal with these people, which was basically the way Trump was talking during the campaign. And by the way, do you agree with me that realism has almost vanished from the American political scene?
Yes. I think, you know, realism, as you know, with a capital R, a school of thought, often gets a bum rap as being very bellicose and always resorting to force too quickly and being bully. And that's exactly wrong. And the way you put it is really quite right. There are problems with it, but its strengths are saying, hey, there's a lot of conflict of interest here, and morality is very difficult to judge, and conflict is very costly for both of us, and you and I have got to figure out what we can do to limit our conflict and not increase it unnecessarily, and going to be some nastiness, but let's think of what's in our mutual interest and how to bargain. I'm going to have to give you some stuff I'd rather not, and it'll be very unpleasant for some people, but that's a lot better than war. It really is in many ways a very peaceful, because it doesn't go in for crusades. And realism has never been popular in the U.S.
Is that right?
There's a marvelous essay by one Arnold Wolfers, who was one of the founders of American realism, which means he was an emigre from Europe in the 30s. He was a Swiss writer and talks about this, and several other people have it. It's very much against the American grain.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one thing that makes American foreign policy difficult. But Trump, in the campaign especially, yes, was talking realism. That's why many of us in the realist community, although there were other things we were very much against, felt there were many things Trump was saying, not all, but many things that were right. And so that we were cross-pressured. We said, hey, you know, he's better on some things than Hillary, especially let's see if we can wind down the hostility with Russia.
Right.
Many of us, not all, I mean, a lot of issues here, many of us felt a reset, to use the word he wouldn't be, of course, associated with Hillary, is exactly right. That might not work, but it might. Part of the conflict with Russia was caused by things we did, especially the expansion of NATO, and it's a long and difficult road, but let's try to make relations better. Now, we thought Trump would be temperamentally unsuitable for the job, but we thought what he was saying was essentially correct. So you have this bizarre thing that the scholar, many of the foreign policy scholars, thought that on some of these issues he was on the right track, which he's now abandoned in some way.
Right. Yeah, now I know people who you might call leftist realists who actually wanted him to win because Hillary's foreign policy instincts, her interventionist instincts, so troubled them. I would call myself, you know, a certain kind of realist on the left, but I never went so far as to actually hope he would win, in part because he just seemed so temperamentally unsuited. And the other thing is, I kind of suspected that there was a chance that he would eventually be co-opted by the Republican foreign policy establishment, which seems to be happening, right?
Yes. I admit to having been surprised at how quickly and totally it seems to have been happening. But yes, I think you're right, and I know others who were more accurate in that than I was. I think part of the reason on Russia, which was one of the big things, is, you know, the fact, and I think it is a fact, that Putin did try to put his thumb on the scale, and then Trump very foolishly denied that, rather than saying, I don't care what Trump wanted, let's see what we can do. I had nothing to do with any of this. Maybe some people I'd cut loose in my campaign, people like, Carter Page. And some of the fringe
characters.
Instead of doing that and cauterizing the root wound, Trump did his craziness, which made it harder for him, I think, to take a more a moderate position.
Right.
And partly he didn't know anyone, and then the advisors he ended up with, especially when Flynn was out, were more traditional.
And so you wound up with a situation where the Syria strike made political sense for him, yes, because it was a way of showing that he would stand up to the Russians.
Yes. And then he gets at least temporarily trapped in that. And then he sends Tillerson to Moscow without having a policy.
Right.
So I don't think it's impossible that he could get back on track. It would be very, very hard because there are very difficult issues. It would take patience, skill, and subtlety. And these are not three words we associate with Trump or with Tillerson, who seems in over his head.
Yeah, is that your sense? Now, I had expected two things of Tillerson. One, I had thought he would himself have basically a realist sensibility, just because of these corporate types who travel the globe tend to have one. Now, on the other hand, then he goes in and tries to get Elliot Abrams as deputy secretary, and that's a neoconservative. That's not a realist. And the other thing is, I had thought Tillerson, although lately I've heard him say some things that seem to show a certain amount of sophistication, but I had assumed he would just be more kind of cosmopolitan than he has sounded, and more knowledgeable about the world than he has sounded early on.
I'm really puzzled. On the one hand, I know some of the people who supported him. And, I mean, it's public that Condi Rice and Robert Gates did. I know Condi Rice because she's a political scientist. We all know each other. And we know Gates's background. Some other people I know who were not as public figures who I respect thought he would do a good job. And, you know, he has some of the skills expected. And my first thought after a couple of weeks is that he was just very weak. He had no basis of support. And I wrote a piece for Foreign Policy Online about why he was a failed Secretary of State, because he was weak. But that's different from his being bad, which I think what we've seen emerge. And I am puzzled. I think part of it is he spent his whole career in ExxonMobil. It's a very high, rigid, hierarchical organization. You don't buck the boss. There's a very rigid lines. You can't do that with foreign policy. You can't do that with the State Department. You've got to reach out, I don't like the phrase, to a lot of different people. You've got to keep a lot of different balls in the air. You've got to, you know, handle sorts of ambiguity of a deeper level. And I don't think he's socialized into that. He's spent his whole career with one style, and that style is inappropriate. And he may also sense that he's in over his head. I mean, he's said really quite a few things that were remarkably foolish. And
any examples come to mind?
Yeah, in the confirmation hearings, we're going to blockade, we're going to keep China from the islands that it is claiming. We're going to blockade them.
Right.
You know, at the end of 6 months policy review, coordinated in the government, thinking of the trade-off and willingness to go to war with China, you might end up with that policy. I mean, I find that unlikely, but, you know, that's, you know, I'm willing to hear the arguments.
Yeah.
To say it in your confirmation hearing, you know, this is just dumb. And then also in the Syria thing, I was just reading one thing that reminded me, he said sort of, this will show we're going to punish evildoers all over the world. I mean, you know, for someone who says very little in public, he makes a remarkable, I mean, his error rate is remarkably high. And I don't know, I don't understand it, and I don't see much improvement.
Now, I guess if you had to list trouble spots where actual conflict could arise between the United States and another country that would come up right now is Iran. In fact, I would think maybe Iran and North Korea are the two leading contenders. How good a job do you think we've done, not just this administration, but in general, and by we, I guess I mean everybody, you know, the whole intelligentsia, commentators, and so on, of just kind of perspective taking, understanding the perspective of Iranian leaders, and perhaps understanding the nature of the power structure as well in Iran.
Well, yeah, Iran is something I've worked on. I got my start in doing serious stuff for the intelligence community, doing a postmortem for CIA, why it was slow to see that the Shah would fall, give the advert published, in addition with the Iraq WMD case and some other things in my book, Why Intelligence Fails. Mm-hmm. So I followed it very much from the outside. I'm not in any way an Iran expert, but I've worked with some of the Iran experts. The Iranian internal politics are very, very intricate and literally foreign to us because they involve ideational systems that are different, obviously, the religion, power structures that are different, and it's highly, highly opaque. So we have pretty good, some good observers in outside. I work with some of the people in our intelligence community that work this, you know, every day, and they're very thoughtful, and some of them deeply knowledgeable, but there are a lot of mysteries. I think we were slow to appreciate the deep differences coming in Iran of their feeling 100 years of humiliation by the West. And not unlike the situation with China, you know, very ancient civilization, very proud, literally taken over by, well, Britain mostly, and Russia in the early part of the 20th century, dominated, then again taken over in spheres of influence by Britain and Soviet Union in World War II. Then, of course, our participation in the Iranian, in restoring, in the coup throughout Mossadegh, which the Iranians attribute to us and the British, although really it was largely internal. The mullahs and the bazaaris, that was a primary function. We did something, but we were, if you will, the straw that broke the camel's back. The Iranians underestimate their own agency. Anyway, but so their whole history is being manipulated from the outside, and then, of course, the great resurgence in pride after the revolution, and the continuing, of course, grievances against the U.S. and the belief that the U.S. continues to try to overthrow the regime, not entirely wrong, but I think exaggerated. I think we were slow to understand the weight of that history. Mm-hmm. I think we were slow to understand the Iranian need for respect and acceptance and the role of the an enrichment program, even if limited, in that. I think Kerry and the backup people really did a great job. And Kerry, who I've never met and I have no, you know, stake in, had great, say, patience and subtlety, more than Hillary Clinton. I don't think Hillary could have pulled off the negotiations. And I think the negotiations ended very well for both sides. And here's, again, where a difference in outlook. Trump seems to think that everything is zero sum. You know, if it's good for us, it's got to be bad for them, and vice versa, which is a crazy perspective, as we all, for deal making.
Well, and you would think one not conducive to success in business. And, of course, one could argue about how actually successful he's been, and whether you might not have been better off just investing the money his father gave him in the stock market and in an index fund, whether he might not have done better. But it's ironic for a business person to so often sound like he thinks both sides can't win.
It is bizarre, and I think part of it is, as I understand it, that he made his real money as a brand. It was The Apprentice that made him, and he's a brand. He brands thing, and then the management, I guess, somehow works. But it is a puzzle, and I think the Iran deal was good for both sides. Again, I have something on this after the deal was signed in Foreign Affairs Online, but to get to your question, I do really worry, because in many of these issues, Mattis and McMaster are the grown-ups in the room. Mm-hmm. On Iran, I don't want to say they're not the grown-ups. That's condescending. They are very, I think, sort of anti-Iranian. And the reason, I believe, is they both had important service in Iraq. And the Iranians were killing American soldiers. Mm-hmm. And they knew that, and they were not allowed to respond as forcibly as they wanted. And maybe Obama was wrong on that. Maybe we think in some areas we probably should have. But, you know, they know that, and that is important in their background. And for Mattis, who's in the Marines, the 83 bombing of the Marine barracks.
Cobar Towers.
Yeah. No, and before that, the Marine barracks in Lebanon.
Oh, okay.
And that's done by Hezbollah, sponsored, ordered, who knows, sponsored by Iran. So that they remember and understandably remember. And my worry is that they will loosen the rules of engagement in the Gulf, because the Iranians have done things that are provocative. And the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guards, Navy, is very hardline. And they do things to provoke the American ships, and the captains both have rules of engagement, say when you can shoot and when you can't. Mm-hmm. And they also, though, have some discretion. You can't micromanage this from Washington. And when you're in a ship and, you know, here are the bad guys charging towards you and not stopping and may be able to, you know, inflict serious damage, temptation to blow them out of the water is pretty high. We've been very self-restrained. I worry that they'll relax the rules of engagement. We'll get shooting there. That won't automatically escalate, but it could lead, if it happens within the next 2 or 3 weeks, to undermining Rouhani, who's up for in the presidential election sometime this month. I've forgotten the exact time. Mm-hmm. And it can spread. So I do worry, because the people who I would trust to be a restraining influence on dealing with North Korea, dealing with Russia, and dealing with China are not as much of a restraining influence here.
Yeah. And this leads to a question about just interpreting actions taken by other leaders.
Yes.
And well, for one thing, how animus toward a regime can influence your reading of the regime. But a fundamental question often is, should we interpret this behavior as offensive or, ironic as it may seem, as defensive?
Yes.
Right? Does it grow out of territorial designs, an attempt to conquer? Or is it, even if it involves the exertion of force beyond Iran's bounds, is it ultimately grounded in a defensive mindset, a fear of invasion by someone like the United States? You know, it seems to me this comes back again and again in international relations. And before we talk about Iran, actually, I'd be interested in hearing your view on how often is this the problem when conflict starts, a misreading of defensive behavior as offensive?
This is where I started my career, where I still am.
And we should say you have a book called Perception and Misperception in International Politics, which you're very well known for.
And that, I'm going to go back even before that. When I was born in 1940, and it was in 47 or 48, when I was 7 or 8, American planes were shot down around the perimeter of Soviet Union. I remember some also off Yugoslavia and the Adriatic. And I remember asking my parents, well, what should we do about this? I mean, how belligerent should our response be? Shouldn't we do this? The Soviets and then the Yugoslavs said, oh, we shot the planes down because they were engaged. They were spying on us. And I thought, we'd never do anything like that. Well, okay, we now know. What were we doing? We were spying on them. We were overflying their territory. Not to completely justify their shooting down the planes, but in some cases it was justified. And two things about that. One, the question of what we call these spirals. countries think well of themselves, and when they are not aiming to do unprovoked harm to others, they can't see why others feel threatened. Now, we knew we were being somewhat provocative, but we didn't think that it merited shooting down our airline, our planes, and of course the American public did not know what we were doing. And that question of sort of on the one hand, what are the other side's intentions, what are its motives, what are its goals, and if we're tough, will that lead them to back down, to oversimplify? If we're conciliatory, will that encourage them, the model of the stereotype of Munich, which has truth to it, or if we're conciliatory, will they reciprocate by being conciliatory? That runs like a thread through an enormous amount of international politics. And trying to diagnose the situation is, you know, very, very difficult. You can argue, again, over stereotype. Britain had three chances to get it right in the 20th century. Before World War I, when they decided Germany was really aggressive, that was wrong, arguably. We go back and forth on that. World War II, in most of the 30s, they thought, no, Hitler just wants to get the ethnic Germans back. If we're too tough, we will increase the paranoia, the sense of encirclement. Mm-hmm. We should be able to appease, which appeasement then meant bring peace to a situation by conciliatory diplomacy. They got that wrong. Cold War, we can debate. No, it is absolutely central, certainly central in the case of Iran. That's why I think the reading of Iran is largely, not completely, defensive. I mean, I think Iran does want greater power in the region. I think, it does sponsor some terrorism, not against us, but it is still a supporter of Hezbollah, somewhat of Hamas. But I think we overestimate that. But that is the key to the argument. The people who think the deal is bad, they'll seize on specific aspects of it. Mm-hmm. But really, it turns on their different image of Iran as irrevocably hostile. Mm-hmm. And the only way to deal with them is, if you can't overthrow the regime, to just show how tough you are. Right. And if you're conciliatory, you won't get concessions from them. You'll just encourage them in their bad ways. It's absolutely central in a great many of the arguments. You know, we have, and other countries have, you have the same argument in Iran, mm-hmm, about how to deal with the U.S.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and just to flesh out some of the issues of interpretation and the things that may seem offensive but could be viewed as defensive. I mean, just to start with what apparently is a big motivator or was a big influence on Mattis and McMaster. Iran was involved in killing American soldiers in Iraq. Of course, from Iran's point of view, when we invaded Iraq, having identified both Iraq and Iran as part of the axis of evil, having in Iran's view sponsored a coup long ago that they never forgot, this was an existential threat. Because for all they knew, and it was not a crazy thought, we might go into Iran next. So if from their point of view, you could see it as a strictly defensive initiative to get the U.S. Army out of that region ASAP. That's not a crazy reading at all. Even Hezbollah, I mean, you might, this is, I think, more complicated because on the one hand, you know, a Muslim nation in that region, the leader can generally pick up some domestic support by vilifying Israel, right? So there's that. But there's also the fact that if you are worried about the U.S. invading, well, having a proxy of yours with 40,000 missiles trained on Israel is not a bad deterrent. Right. I mean, that is an actual kind of strength that presumably you could deploy in the event that the U.S. started threatening you. So, I mean, you can go all day on these things and then you. Well, let's just leave it there. I guess the thing. I don't mean leave it there. I mean, leave it there before I let you jump in. All I was going to add was. It strikes me how absent considerations like that are from policy, the visible part of policy discourse, at least. I mean, if you look at the think tanks in Washington, which in theory would be an ideologically diverse array, and you listen to the people employed there, they basically never say stuff like this. Now, it may be wrong, but yeah. It really, these considerations should be part of the conversation, right?
Oh, I think definitely. And I do think the spectrum is quite truncated. One thing just on that now, and I want to go back to Iran. I think the Beltway discussion of Russia, judging just from one or two Beltway meetings I've had, so I could be wrong, my sample's limited, I thought was remarkably limited in, you know, it was from the center to the hawkish, and not as much on, gee, maybe, you know, the expansion of NATO, the independence of Kosovo, which violated several promises we gave, you know, related things. Now, I don't mean to say for a minute that closes the argument that my good friend and colleague Steve Susanovich, who's a Russian expert and very balanced, says, wait a minute, we did all these things, and yet for a period we did have good relations, etc. But that whole view was just not represented. And certainly true on Iran, which I think has been demonized, partly thanks to Ahmadinejad, who itself demonized.
He made it pretty easy.
Yeah. It's a little like what Churchill said about John Foster Dulles, who said, he's a bull who takes his own china shop around with him. So, but what you said is exactly right. We were in their neighborhood, and it's even worse because when we invaded at first, Iran was quite helpful to us. And we were cooperating on many levels. And then we had, not only, well, before then, we had the Axis of Evil speech. Then we had cutting off all conversations with Iran. And my friend and former colleague, Zalmay Khalilzad, has written about this, and he was in the Bush administration as ambassador to Afghanistan, then ambassador to Iraq, and then ambassador to the UN. And he's talked about the times he's not a radical lefty, pro-Iranian softy. He felt you could deal with Iran, or at least discuss, and he wanted to talk to the Iranians, to talk about our really great common interest, and the Bush White House vetoed that. And in fact, he got severely criticized, I think it's by Elliot Abrams, I may be wrong on it, but anyway, someone in the Bush White House, for being on, I guess it was a panel in Davos or something, literally being in the room with the Iranian. Well, what can you say? It just, that was, I believe, a lost opportunity. Maybe it wouldn't have gone anywhere. But again, the same mindset that it's all their fault. There's sitting in the same room will just encourage them. And say, given the situation that we're surrounding them, we're still, you know, in Afghanistan as well as Iraq, we are probably supporting Iranian separatists. I probably don't know, but about half of Iran is a little under half are not Persians. They're various minorities, and we certainly have worked with them in the past, and I'm sure the Iranians believed with some reason, whether it was right or not, I don't know, with some reason we were working with them then, and we say, why are you doing this? You don't know. Now, I don't mean to say that their hands are clean,
right,
and we should have just rolled over and had our tummies scratched, but not to see if we couldn't reach some understandings or have some sense for why they might be doing these things, right, given the threat we pose to them. And the basic point is about the difficulties of offense and defense on the strategic thing. I go, back to, there's a saying from one of the czars in, God knows, 17th century, that which stops growing begins to rot. That is the basic argument that unless you expand, you're going to be subject to attack.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very difficult thing. The basic motive is to be secure. You can't be secure unless you get more. Is what I call a deep security dilemma. It's very, very hard to deal with. And I think we've got a number of cases like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the disclaimer you threw in there a minute ago when you said, I'm not saying their hands are clean. You know, the you kind of felt necessary to say you weren't approving morally of them, and it's interesting that you feel the need to throw that in, because I think one of the great impediments to analysis is the assumption that to explain why someone does something is to approve of what they did.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's why you have to keep throwing these disclaimers in.
Yeah.
But I just think in a way, you know, you've studied so much about the human mind. I think in a way, this intuition, and it's a deep human intuition, I think we all have it,
yeah,
that once somebody starts explaining why somebody did something that's bad, they are trying to absolve the person. That intuition, I think, is a great impediment to clear understanding.
Yes, it is. I think that is right. And it'd be interesting how much is cultural, if we can strip out the layer, how much is human nature, you've written about. Probably some of each. I think the U.S., back to the American exceptionalism, I think the U.S., especially attitude to foreign policy, is more moralistic, because throughout our history, we've had what one great historian, C. Van Woodward, called free security, surrounded by two large oceans and two weak countries. You know, now in the early 19th century, the British were able to burn Washington. I wish they'd built it back a prettier city. But anyway, but after that, we had, no one could invade us until then you get one, bombers and missiles. And I think that's what part of the reason why realism is not so popular. And the other side, the converse of realism, or one of its converses, is a moralism. And that makes it harder for us. But I don't think it is uniquely American. And I think also, I've done work with the intelligence community, and it's one of the things that makes their life difficult, because they're supposed to explain how other countries see the world and what they're going to do, and part of it is how other countries see us. And it's hard if you write an intelligence paper saying, hey, you know, there's a big gap to your boss about the way you, as the administration, see yourself and the way they see it. It's a sensitive ground.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, again, the realism, which has a degree of cynicism, is very useful. And the cynicism says, look, you know, they see us this way, they've got their blinders, but I'm willing to accept that without having it cast doubt on my own views, that actually my own behavior is appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very hard.
I think
Obama was much better at that. And I say that I'm not a fan of all the Obama foreign policy. I think he had a much greater sense of that, certainly than Bush. And then Trump is this odd mixture.
Right. a volatile mixture, I feel.
Yes.
Well, listen, we're coming up against an hour, so we should probably call it a day. But it's been a great chat. And the book is How Statesmen Think, The Psychology of International Politics. It's, it's got so many dimensions. It encompasses so much of your work in recent years. So you get into, Cold War stuff, the question of to what extent the national identities of the United States and Russia kind of figured into the way that played out. You get into the intelligence failure in the Iraq War, the famous intelligence failure, and intelligence failures more generally. You get into the way cognitive biases like loss aversion can play out. And there's just a ton of stuff in the book, so much so that maybe down the road you should come back on and we should talk some more, because I've really, really found this interesting. And so thank you so much,
thank
Bob.
Thank you.
And we'll talk to you next time.
Great.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.